Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Lisa Mullen. Starting Sunday, visitors to Boston's Museum of Fine Arts will be able to set their eyes on a collection of treasured works, most of which haven't been seen together since the Nazis stole them from their owners in 1938.
And those owners were the Rothschilds. The Rothschild dynasty gained unprecedented power in banking, mining, and the railroad industries back in the 17th century. The family amassed a collection of European decorative arts, prints, drawings, furnishings, and rare books. The heirs to the Austrian branch of the Rothschilds family have donated 186 objects, to the Museum of Fine Arts.
It has taken generations for the Rothschild family to recover the artwork, and the final phase of that recovery and the shepherding of the works to the MFA was undertaken by our guest in the studio now, Bettina Burr. She is the granddaughter of the woman who possessed the original collection, the Baroness Clarice de Rothschild. Thank you, Bettina Burr, for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is a story that melds history and war and art and family, your family, really the dedication of three women, you, your grandmother, and your mother. Your mother's name was Bettina Laram de Rothschild. Could you start off by taking us to your family's home in Austria in March of 1938? Your grandmother and grandfather were out of the country at the time. They were in London. Your mother was, I think, 13 years old. What happened?
Yes, my mother and her sister, Gwen, who was 11 years old at the time, were in Vienna, and my grandparents were in London. So when the Anschluss happened, when the Germans crossed the border into Austria, my grandparents, of course, heard about it and cabled the house to evacuate the girls immediately to Switzerland, where they would meet them. The girls were put on the train early the next morning and were trying to get to Switzerland. However, as they approached Innsbruck, the train slowed down, and my mother remembered hearing screaming from the platform, and they were screaming, "All Jews off the train."
That included your mother and her sister.
My mother and her sister were taken off the train to the municipal police station, clapped into jail. My mother remembers being there all day. She played word games to make the time pass. At 4 o'clock, the cell doors clanged open, and the two girls were allowed to leave.
Why do you think they were only held for one night?
They were only held for the day, actually, because the Nazis had caught a bigger fish, namely my grandfather's younger brother, who was called Louis. And Louis was the head of the bank, and the Germans were determined to get their hands on the vast fortune of this branch of the Rothschilds, which also included iron and coal mines in Czechoslovakia. With Louis, they had a better chance for a larger ransom than if they held the little girls.
And one thing that Hitler wanted in particular was the artwork. He had a goal in mind for it, the artwork that was held by your family for generations.
Yes, exactly. Within perhaps 2 weeks of the occupation, the Nazis had emptied my grandfather and his brother Louis' houses and had taken the collection to a central depot where it was overseen by members of the Kunsthistorisches Museum and, of course, Hitler's prime curator, if you like, who selected treasures that were destined to go to the Führermuseum in Linz.
Now, this is something that Malcolm Rogers, the head of the MFA, told WBUR's arts reporter Andrea Shea about, that Hitler wanted to bring the works of your family to his own museum that he had planned for Linz, Germany.
The grandiosity of those plans, the fact that the effort to build the collection was Europe-wide while he was concentrating on conquering the world, art had such power for him.
What kind of power, though, at the same time, did the artwork, did the collection bring to your family? Because it worked to their disadvantage because the Nazis, Hitler wanted it, but also to their advantage. How so?
Yes, because we were very fortunate in that during the war, the pieces had actually been moved for safekeeping to mines in Altaussee. And after the war, the monuments men recovered the vast trove of treasure in the mines and carefully cataloged and labeled everything. And my grandmother went to see what there was and found crates labeled A.R. Alphonse Rothschild. And they were able to get those pieces back. However, they were not able to take the collections out of the country.
Out of Vienna? Why not? Out of Austria? How come?
That is because the Austrian government pointed to a law that had been passed in 1918 that forbade art export.
Which was a law on the books, but as was determined later on, a rather immoral law. So what they convinced your grandmother to do was what?
To donate what the Austrians wanted to keep for Austria to the museums in Austria. And then she was allowed to leave with the rest of the collection.
What happened after that?
Well, the works remained in the Austrian museums for about 50 years. My mother would go to see them in the galleries and also when they were not on view in the basement or in the storage areas of the museums, check on them, make sure they were all right. And she'd ensure that the label, which stated that this work had been donated by Clarice de Rothschild in memory of her husband, Alphonse de Rothschild, was clearly visible, yes.
And bring this story now to your mother, because your mother is a major mover in what happened. She was only a child, but she when these artworks were taken, she remembers some of them. She grew up with them. What was her role in this?
She remembered all the pieces. She, however, never looked back. She was a force of nature and very positive and a can-do kind of person. And as we all thought, the contract that had been signed in 1949 by my grandmother was a legally binding contract, and she'd never get those pieces that were in the museum back. However, she had been in the hospital having surgery when she read in the newspaper that the Austrian culture minister had ordered the national museums to look at their collections to see if there was any Nazi loot, so to speak, or works that had been obtained through pressured sales or possibly donations. And she thought, well, I have nothing to lose. And she rang the minister up, and 10 minutes later, the minister ran back. For the rest of the year and continuing into the next, she worked very hard. There were two journalists that she worked with who had done research on what they called the second looting by Austrian museums of Jewish families to have the law changed. And it was indeed changed, and she recovered the pieces that were in the museum.
What are the pieces? Not all of the pieces that were recovered are in the collection that was given to the MFA. Some of them, I guess, have been auctioned off. You and your family have some of them as well. Is there one piece that you think when folks go to see this collection at the Museum of Fine Arts, they should take a look at because it has a particular story behind it, either the story that exemplifies the rest of the collection or one particular story?
Well, it's hard to isolate a piece. I think that the work that most people will be attracted to is the painting of Lady Hamilton. This is the actress Emma Hart, who became Nelson's mistress. It's a beautifully painted picture, and she is so beguiling. It's hard not to look at her. But I think that for workmanship, the small boxes and what they call carnets de bal, which are where dance cards were actually held, are superb examples of French 18th century workmanship. And then, of course, there are the books. And if you look carefully at some of the books, you'll see the stamp of the Third Reich, the Hitler stamp of the eagle, which is, I think, quite interesting.
And hard for you to look at, I would think.
Well, yes and no. It is hard to see because it speaks of a time that was a sad time, but it's also a feeling of, well, things have come out all right.
Bettina Brewer is an heir of Bettina Loram de Rothschild and vice president of the MFA's Board of Trustees, the collection of her family's, part of her family's art collection, is going to be opening next week at the Museum of Fine Arts. Thank you very much for coming in to speak to us about it.
Thank you very much.
Time now for the Remembrance Project, our series with writer Alyssa Eli, who shares stories about ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives.
Today, it's to remember Jerry Williams, who connected New England and India, Mahatma Gandhi, and Martin Luther King.
Jerry Williams died August 25, 2014, in Goffstown, New Hampshire. That's 6.3 miles from the town of Dunbarton, where for over 50 years he practiced his belief that making ceramics and making peace were imperatively linked. He was 88 years old and, as someone described, oddly detached and 100% present. He lived in rural New Hampshire, but began life in rural India, where his parents taught Bengali school children. Jerry's father persuaded Gandhi that septic systems were a necessity for sanitation and installed the first toilet in his ashram. In turn, Gandhi's writings persuaded Jerry that pacifism was a necessity for life. Leaving India for college in Iowa, Jerry registered as a conscientious objector. During World War II, he was assigned to test malarial treatments. He and other objectors were inoculated with glassfuls of mosquitoes overturned on their chests. Then they'd play cards in an isolated hospital ward for a week, waiting for symptoms to hit. In 1950, rather randomly, he came upon a description in a book, a potter sitting by the road selling his wares. Jerry had never touched a piece of clay before, but his daughter said the image of this practical craftsman, connected by his hands to earth, struck him like a shaft of light. Soon he had apprenticed himself to a master potter in New Hampshire and was digging his own clay from the nearby mudflats. A second shaft of light struck a few years later when his future wife interviewed him for the radio show she hosted. She was not a potter, and yet body and soul they were immediately joined. They raised a family, co-created an international ceramic magazine, hosted workshops in their home, and traveled the world together. Always together. He must have thrown 10,000 singular pots. His daughters thought of them as siblings, and loved when customers used his works for holding pencils. He was famous for a rare oxblood red glaze, which he made by hand-mixing chemicals without any protection. That was a toxic irony for someone so bound to the natural world. Artists from everywhere visited for the joy of watching him throw his pots and listening to him philosophize. He was passionate about civil rights and preoccupied with political moments. The evening Martin Luther King was shot, he rushed into the house, covered with clay, to follow the news with his family. When his wife entered her final illness, a few years before he entered his own, Jerry quietly shut down his kiln. There are pots he never finished, still inside.
The Remembrance Project airs weekly on Radio Boston. To nominate somebody for a profile, email remembrance@wbur.org. There's more information at radioboston.org.
There's more of the show in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Radio Boston.